Hi, I'm Kay.
Hi, Kay.
God, you never forget your name because otherwise everybody reacts. It's kind of, it says, remember to say your name, remember to say your name. But let's pray because I need that tonight. So God, grant us a serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So here are my notes. I never have notes for one of these affairs. And I was asked to speak, and I realized how big, at this point, my story is. I came in the 80s. I came into Al-Anon. And I actually spoke at this meeting 10 years ago. I'm like stunned by how time goes. And a lot's happened in 10 years, just 10 years. So the whole story is just... It's way too big. I have to be very careful. I've asked to be timed carefully because it's a big, unwieldy, crazy, insane story that starts out with both of my parents being alcoholics. And they got married right after the war, maybe during the war. I don't know. They met in the service. And my dad came back. He saw action in World War II, so he came back not only as an alcoholic, but post-traumatic stress. And so it's not a good beginning. And my mother, I think, honestly, she was an alcoholic, and she had other addictions. Her parents were religious fanatics. I think there's an interesting thing about that my grandfather, neither of my mother's parents drank, and they were religious fanatics, but my grandfather owned a bar, and he used to sit behind a two-way mirror and watch people drink. And I don't know what that's about or what that means, but it just made me curious about that. But the unwieldy part of the story is they proceeded to have 10 children. So there's, you know, we're Irish Catholic, and my dad used to make that joke, oh, one for the Pope every year. Well, you know, it's not actually funny. It's true, but it's not funny at all. And so if I started listing the kind of insanity that went into my home, I thought, oh, I'll go through each one of the kids and sort of like tell you, because we're all alcoholics or drug addicts, except for my oldest sister, and she has other addictions. But what I was going to say about my mother is I really believe she has had a personality disorder. I think she was, I can't think of the name of it right now. Doesn't matter, it'll come back to me. My dad was bipolar, and probably from the war, but who knows what else. His father was an alcoholic, so, you know, that's his whole story. And I used to go to therapists, and I used to tell therapists that my mother had this personality disorder, and they would always not believe me. I don't know why, because why I don't have the personality disorder, I have a lot of the characteristics of it. It's called borderline. My mother was borderline, and I have a lot of borderline tendencies, and eventually I became a therapist so I could have diagnosed this. That's how nuts we are, you know? It's like, and then I became a therapist so I could diagnose my mother. Is that insane? I mean, that's how insane this all is. So I want to get this over with fast. Where's my timer? Oh, there. I know, but I just want to know where to look. So the thing I want to get over with is how many people are alive in my family. My brother actually, probably the one I was closest to, who was a drug addict, he died of a heroin overdose. So, you know, they've got 10 kids here, so I'll talk about him. And then right after that, my sister committed suicide. And I think my brother, having had a drug overdose and being the first one out of this large, crazy family to go, I think he gave her permission then probably to commit suicide. She started to get sober really late in life, and then when she see, if I start into these stories, I'm never going to get through this, but what happened was her body was so broken from the years of drinking, and she was mainly a street alcoholic, that when she started to get sober, she was in so much pain physically that mostly, you know, the painkillers, the overdrug painkillers basically took her out. And so she didn't have much of a chance. But also by the time she got sober, which I think was starting to get sober, like in her late 30s or 40s, she started to look around and see that all her friends had gotten married and had kids, and some of them were having grandkids, and you know, and it's like, and she had no, she, I mean, she was a street alcoholic, and so, you know, sometimes some of these deaths are like, I'm almost grateful for them because, you know, there's a lot of relief in some of that stuff. And so, and the other thing, when my dad died, ended up dying of cancer. It was prostate cancer that became bone cancer. He and one of my youngest brother, was a year younger than I am, they were so codependent with each other, so dramatically codependent with each other, that they died of the exact same thing a year apart, almost to the day. So you usually hear about that with married couples, you know, who get so enmeshed that they can't separate out. And but I, in families, it happens, you know, it happens all over the place. And those two just got so tied up together that I look at that and think, you know, I'm not the least bit surprised that that's how it happened. My mother did not die of alcoholism, which just amazed me. All she ever really wanted to do was drink. She loved being pregnant, by the way. She loved being pregnant. She loved the birth. She had no maternal instinct. She had no interest in raising children. And basically, she dedicated her life to drinking. And, you know, on her deathbed, if she could have had a drink, she would have. And, you know, I just think that's so sad. And the other thing that I think is sad, and I'm going to get to me, I basically want to talk about me and my recovery. But, you know, I feel like I need a little bit of a background. But I think the other sad thing is that, you know, what a relief it was when they died. And I don't think you're supposed to think that about your parents. They just used me up so emotionally that even later on, you're going to hear about my recovery with my dad. It's just so sad that even after I'd done amends with them and so forth, that it was a big relief. And, you know, I just, that's the sadness of these stories, you know. And so anyhow, I try not to ever give my family more than 5 minutes, because it would just take me down the wrong road. Unless you guys just wanted to camp out here tonight. It just, I doubt that. So I started to think about this story and how cumbersome it was, and I'm thinking, oh, I've got to have notes, and I have to, in order to tell this story. And then somehow, over the next 3 days, it came to me that I wanted to talk about the steps, because what happened was, no matter how crazy and how insane it got, I'd go to the steps. And then I'd go to the steps some more. And then no matter what was going on, I would go back to the steps. And it was the steps, it is the steps, that is the glue that has held my life together. And I'll tell you how I got into program. There's so many things I don't want to tell you. I think I'd gone through two husbands by the time I found program. And that was just a horrible mess. My second husband was actually a nice guy. We were both adult children of alcoholics with absolutely zero recovery. His father was just a terrible alcoholic. And, you know, so we just recognized each other and jumped into a relationship. And I'll tell you why we got married. We got married because he had gone into real estate. We're young. He had gone into real estate and wanted to sell my car to buy a decent car for real estate. So that's why we got married, because he couldn't sell my car. He couldn't sell my car unless he married me. And so we got married. Is that romantic or what? I mean, it just follows the insanity of, like, what I understood life to be, seriously. And he was not a bad guy, and we were for the most part nice to each other. With that's the good news. And then we got divorced. And my dad said to me, and I'd been all over the country by then. We'd lived in Florida, and I was living up in Toronto, and then got divorced in Newport, Rhode Island. And then, you know, just moving around, because you're never settled. I mean, you know, the hole inside me was so deep that, and I was looking for something, you know, to fill that hole and to get me out of physical pain. I was just in pain all the time, and I didn't know why I was in pain all the time. I am an alcoholic. I got sober. I'm going to mix that story up. So I'm just going to say that when I got divorced the second time, I was talking to my dad on the phone, and he said, well, you don't have to live in Cleveland. I'm from Cleveland. But you don't know where you want to be, so why don't you come home and, you know, get yourself together and figure out what you want to do. And so I went home, and my drinking had escalated quite a bit. I'm not going to go into my drinking story. That's... You know, a friend of mine said recently, you know, I just can't picture you with a drink in your hand. And I went, good. that was the result I was looking for. So, you know, that's really a good thing. My sister, my oldest sister, dragged me to and I'm still drinking, by the way, dragged me to an Al-Anon meeting because she thought that my sister needed Al-Anon and we should go check out Al-Anon so that we could fix my sister. And I was really angry with her. I remember being really angry with her because I was in so much pain. And why weren't we talking about me? Why were we talking about Barbara? So I was aware of Al-Anon. Also, God, this is such a crazy story. My dad got sober when I was in high school. And one of the things I used, this is how disconnected you can get. One of the things I used to do on Friday nights, my dad would go to a meeting and I'd go along with him for something to do. So it's not like I hadn't seen AA. I mean, I couldn't relate to it. I didn't know why. I mean, it didn't have anything to do with me. It was like I was keeping my dad company in AA, and he seemed to love to have one of the kids with him when he'd go to meetings. Crazy. But you think that I'd catch on, you know, it's like, oh, there's this drinking. But, you know, I think coming from a big Irish family, we drank from the time I was little. I mean, I woke up in the mornings and my parents would have had big parties and the kids would all go through and we'd collect the drinks and make drinks. And drinking was just such a way of life in my culture and in my home. And interestingly enough, the people who should have been models for me in my life, like the priests and nun, there were a lot of clergy in my family, lawyers, doctors, they came to our house to drink. You know, they came in the door and what do you want to drink? There was never, you know, it's just so part of the culture that, you know, I wouldn't think that drinking had anything to do with the kind of problems that I was having. And of course, it was like most of it. But so I don't want to get off into the drinking story, but I ended up finally going to Al-Anon probably because I was in a relationship with another sick alcoholic once again, and I'm still drinking, by the way. And that was an interesting experience because I'm sitting in Al-Anon one night and this guy's sitting next to me and he said, you know what, if my wife fell over dead drunk here, I'd walk right over her. And I thought, boy, am I in the wrong room. Oh my God, you know. But eventually this woman came and who was an Al-Anon, who was also an alcoholic, and she told her story, and she was this Irish Catholic from the west side of Cleveland, and I heard the story, and it woke me up, and I started going to meetings. It's not nearly that simple, but that's the story for tonight. And then what happened was, as I started to sober up, now the shit hits the fan because there isn't this, oh, now we're sober and there's white light and rainbows and we're happy. It just got me into more pain is what it did. And so I had to start facing myself, which wasn't a good day when you wake up and start facing yourself. That was really tough. And the interesting thing was, I want to talk about the steps. So the first step, because I did the steps, well, you know how I did the steps. I'm a college graduate. I took it like a syllabus and went, oh, I can do this. You know, this is easy. And so I took the steps and I did them myself. You know, I don't need anybody to explain this to me. You know, it's like, I got this thing. So that was my first attempt. And it, guess what? It didn't work. I was still in pain. So anyhow, I want to talk about the first step because I had a very low bottom. You know, some of my first sponsors would say that, you know, if they had come as low as I had, they would have done something. And I just, you know, I think from years of growing up in such a crazy situation, that, you know, bring it on. I can figure this out. I can do this. I just had a very low bottom. And so it took me a long time to get powerless. I actually think I went through the steps maybe three times before I actually became powerless. It wasn't an easy thing for me. I don't trust it. I don't like it. Ridiculous, you know. But I finally got to the point where, you know, I think I woke up one morning, and by that time I had broken up with this crazy alcoholic. I had offed my family. I wasn't speaking to any of them. And I was working for myself, so I had no boss. So if I was still in pain, I had to figure out that I was doing it to me, and that there wasn't anybody else left to be, you know, creating this situation in my life. And you know why? It was probably the best day of my life. It was probably the worst day of my life. It was just awful. So the insanity wasn't hard to figure out. That's my second step, like how crazy I had gotten, how far down I had gone. By this time, the men I'm hooking up with probably should be in jail for the criminally insane. And, you know, and I mean that sincerely, even though that's sort of embarrassing to say, the kind of people I was attracting into my life, sober, by the way, was just insane. So, you know, I couldn't, the kind of good thing about that was there wasn't one day I could wake up and think, oh, well, it's not that bad. I mean, I was in a fatal attraction by that time. Oh, it's not that bad. Things are okay. I don't need this. You know, every day was rough. Let me tell you, every day was rough. And so the third step was turning my life and my will over. And I just took to that to like a duck to water because, I just had to turn my life and my will over because there wasn't anywhere else to go. There wasn't anything else to do. And then I turned my life and my will over again, and then I turned my life and my will over again. When I finally did a proper four step, I was so nervous about, because in these alcoholic families, you don't share, you don't trust, you'd never tell anybody things like that, you know? It's like, it's just not done, you know? It's just not done. And I'm breaking the code of silence, and, you know, my father had a pretty good standing in the community. People loved my parents. They just loved my parents. It was like so insane because, you know, once you went inside the house and shut the door, it wasn't pretty. It was not pretty. My father was brutal with my brothers, physically brutal with my brothers, and sometimes the girls, but not too often. So the first time I did a proper four-step, I used a Catholic priest because I knew that he'd go to hell or he'd have to off himself if he broke my trust, you know. And I'll tell you, when I was doing my fifth step, you know, and he'd say to me, so what was your part in that? I really did not understand what the hell he was talking about, really. When he said, what is your part in that? It's like, I didn't have a part in that. He did that to me. Don't you get it? He did that to me, you know? And it's like, so, you know, it took a while to come to the place where what's my part, and now I have to figure it out. And that was a big recovery piece for me. The sixth step, becoming entirely ready. I don't do that. I'm an action person. So, you know, I like to roll up my sleeves and dig in. And this concept of like becoming entirely ready just like boggled my mind, messed me up, mixed me up. And I just didn't like it at all. I caught on. I really did. But again, you know, my recovery was so painful and so long. And then the business about being humble, I was talking in a meeting about that because one of my father's favorite things to say is, now that I have humility, I have everything, and we're done here. And so I sort of took up that gauntlet. But this business of waiting around, I went to an awful lot of meetings. I think at that point, I had so given up on anything else that I was in daily meetings, and there were still crazy things going on in my life. And so then this eighth step, you know, this business of becoming ready to make amends to people. Oh my gosh. You know, I did eventually make an amends with my second husband. I waited 8 or 9 years before I did that. And I wrote him a letter. Both of us were unfaithful to each other at different times in the relationship. And it took about 8 or 9 years to write that letter. We used to talk to each other once a year. And then after that, I was getting ready to move from Cleveland to California. And we had our last phone call. And I said, you know, I don't really need to keep, you know, we've done the amends. I don't really need to keep. Well, the one thing he did say to me is, because I sent him the letter, I said, read it, and then we'll have a talk. And he said, you were so hard on yourself. And I said, well, it was only my half. And there was dead silence on the phone. So that wasn't like a good thing. But I said, you know, you're welcome to call me. He remarried the day after our divorce. He was, you know, and I know. I kept saying, you know, why don't you wait a day, an hour, or something? but he didn't, and he got. I think I don't know what kind of really. But again, you know, I'm not going to fault him. And I had another marriage after that, and then I came out here and discovered that there was such a thing as a sober relationship. There's, honest to God, a thing as a sober relationship, you know, and not anything I ever saw in my family or, you know, or friends or anyone, you know, relatives. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So the eighth step I wrote out. I don't know what I wrote out. I want to talk about the eighth and ninth step because... that was a really interesting thing. When I was just a year sober, I went to a workshop in, I'm living in Cleveland, I went to a workshop in Charlestown, not Charleston, Charlestown, Virginia, and I ran into this woman that I had known from my drinking days, and I wasn't on that step. And I had to convince myself that because I would probably never see her again, I made an amends with her, and she was like, oh, no, you don't really. And I went, yeah, I really do. And she went, yeah, you really do. And so that was kind of an interesting amends. And then after I was out here for a while, I went back to Ohio, to Oberlin. There was a 12-step thing at Oberlin. That's not why I went back, but I went and did a workshop there. And I'm sitting in the chapel in Oberlin, and for the closing, and I realized that my ex-boyfriend's best friend is sitting behind me, and I knew I owed him an amends. I knew I'd never see him again, and I cannot figure out how to do that. And it's, you know, talk about spiritual awakenings. I get little spiritual awakenings all the time, and it's like, turn around and say you're sorry. You can do that. Can't you just say you're sorry? You know, it's like, well, when we got up, I turned around, I saw Roger, and I told him I was sorry. And then we had this nice little conversation. And then I went to my car, and I don't know how he got to my car before I did. I really don't. But when he was in my car, when I got to my car, I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, it's the first time I've ever done this, and I wanted to make sure I had done it right. So we had this another little discussion, and it turns out that we had a telephone conversation just before I left for Ohio for Cleveland, and I talked about my recovery, and he said that I sent him literature, and that's how he ended up in the program. And I'll tell you, I remember the phone call, but I certainly don't remember sending him literature. I just thought that was like an amazing thing. But the thing is, I've got one more thing to say about this amends thing, is that when I left Cleveland, I started reading this book called Toxic Parents. I think that was the name of it. But basically, the book said that some parents are just so toxic that you really don't ever owe them an amends. And I sort of was like, okay, well, maybe that's good. Because by that time, I wasn't talking to my father, and that was a pretty unusual thing. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go to California, and I'm going to go to Al-Anon, and I'm going to work out this amends problem there. And I'll tell you, honest to God, I kept thinking my group must have been so sick of hearing me talk about that thing, because it, honest to God, went on for years. This wasn't a simple thing, because I couldn't figure out how I owed them amends, those two crazy nut jobs. And so... So what happened was, one of my nieces sent me a letter, and the letter the letter said that, you know, my older sister was having a 50th birthday or something, and they wanted memories. They wanted me to write some memories of things that happened when we were a kid. And I'll tell you what, I could not think of any memories that were, you know, that didn't end up with my father hitting Jay. Honestly, every memory I have is my father hitting Jay. So, and then I started to really think about it from an Al-Anon point of view, and I thought, you know, I was on the other end of all those bad times. I probably wasn't the sister she wanted. I probably didn't do the things she needed or wanted or thought would have been, like, good. And so I was able to write this letter to her that said, you know, that I was sorry if I had disappointed her. I was sorry if I had hurt her. Because I didn't know how I did it. I mean, you know, it's like we're all in survival here. We're just all trying to keep our head above water and, like, get through life. I mean, because of this, how insane this whole thing was. And then after I did that, I thought, well, if I could do that with my sister, why couldn't I do that with my parents? And as a result of that, that was basically the letter that they got. And as a result of that, my father immediately called me. And, you know, I had so much, he was really fun. My dad was a blast. And the last 10 years of his life, I got to hang out with him and have a blast. And he had money too, which was really fun, you know, because then you could, like, do stuff, do really cool stuff, you know. And so, but it's amazing because I never ever believed that could happen. The only way it could happen is through this program and through these steps. And as I say, no matter how crazy things got, I just kept grabbing onto these steps and holding onto these steps. And what step am I on? And how am I going to work that? The other interesting thing was that my mother did not have that reaction. The thing I discovered is that we had nothing in common, and that even if none of this had happened, we wouldn't have been friends. I mean, we never understood each other. And I was telling somebody the other day, you know, it's like what I was interested in and what she was interested in was not the same. It was just, I got to be a good daughter is what happened. In those 10 years, I got to be a good daughter to my mother. And I didn't have to be her best friend. I didn't have to have a relationship with her. The relationship was, I was a good daughter. So now she's gone, and I get to feel that. And it's just, like, amazing that happened, because that's nothing I thought up, trust me. You know, you get a counseling degree, it doesn't mean you know these things for other people. You don't know them for yourself, you know. It was Richard Feynman who said that you know, it's very easy to be fooled, but the person who is easiest to fool is yourself. And so, you know, I did this with sponsors, I did this in therapy, and I did a lot of things, but I still hung on to the steps, no matter what. I went to treatment twice for codependency, once with Terry Kellogg in Ohio, and then out in the Meadows, I did a week of what they call Survivor's Week. But it didn't matter, and it seemed like everything I did worked, it was just fabulous, but if I didn't have the steps, it wouldn't, you know, you don't throw it all away because you find a guru. You know, I've had gurus too. That's another stupid story. Oh my gosh. I better get to that before. So step 10 is doing a daily inventory. And I do that now, honestly. You know, I lied to my handyman. And I'm going to tell you, I had to tell him the truth. And he was such a pain in the ass about that. Honestly, he did not let me off the hook at all. And I'm just like, I hate this. And so it's just easier, really, to tell the truth and to not get yourself into these nutty situations where you have to go back and go, well, I lied about the money. Ah. And so I'm not going to say more about that. It's just great. But, you know, the daily inventory is really, really important. And I think that if you get really clean in the small things, that later on when the big kahuna comes down, that you'll be able to do it, even though it's going to hurt you, or even though it's going to embarrass you, or either it's going to cost you money or whatever, that if you keep it really clean in the till and so forth on a daily basis, that, you know, it really, when it comes to the big situations where you have to tell the truth, it's a whole lot easier. So, you know, that's advice. I know I'm not supposed to be giving advice, but, well, that's how it works for me. How's that? So So sought through, 11 is sought through prayer and meditation. And I, the prayer thing I always had down, serenity prayer, you know, it's just, it's, I say it constantly, I really do. I wanted to talk about this. Okay, so a prayer came easily. That's not the one I had to struggle with. God came easily. You know, I just, even as a young child, I had a sense of a power greater than myself. Not the Catholic God, but a power greater than myself that, you know, something protected me because, you know, I had a lot of not good things happen to me, but not the way they could have. I mean, it could have been a whole lot worse. And so, you know, I was just out there with no boundaries and very immature and hid from a lot of people. That saved me a little bit. But as far as I absolutely forgot what I was talking about. The prayer thing, I just, you know, that I had. And, you know, thank God for the constant contact because that's how I'm alive. There's nobody in my family who has any recovery. Even my dad, you know, he quit drinking, but then he started having affairs and, you know, and he used AA like a social club. So anyhow, but the meditation thing, you know, you want to talk about insanity. So I decide one day that I haven't really done the steps right because I don't meditate. And I'm going to figure out how to meditate. Don't you know I end up in India? Nobody asked me to go to India. They asked me to, like, pray and meditate. And it's like, it's insane how these things happen. You know, it's just, but I did. I ended up in India. And then I discovered at the end of all this that basically, I don't meditate the way other people meditate. And I think, you know, I don't know if this is an opinion, but, you know, someone whose opinion I respect said that actually that sitting meditation is not great for women. We do better with things like walking meditation. And so, you know, get out the vacuum. Honestly, it takes you into a theta state, and that's how you meditate. And I remember Ram Dass one time he gave this back in the 60s. He'd give these talks, you know, about meditation and all that. And one day he was up there, and there was this woman in the front row, and she was elderly, and she's nodding her head and nodding her head. Well, he's talking to a group of hippies. He doesn't, you know, he's trying to figure out what's wrong with this woman that she's there. But afterwards, she came up, and he said he even got a little more flamboyant just because she was there, and he wanted to, like, see if he could, like, knock her out. And afterwards, she came up to him, and she said, oh, I just, everything you said, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, how do you know these things? And she goes, oh, I knit. You know, there's lots of ways to meditate. There's Cricket in the back with her knitting. You know, so, I mean, don't take that too seriously. Nothing good happened to me in India, trust me. It really didn't work out. But today I meditate in a different way. And so, you know, we have to, like, go with what we have. So the 12th step is the most important step. You know, because if you don't share this program, in my mind, you whistled in the wind. I mean, it's interesting because a lot of people, I've been in since the 80s, and a lot of people come and sit in the program, and it's perfectly fine. It's a great idea to come and sit because it's comforting. And boy, when you're in these alcoholic situations and you do not know which way up is, sitting in a meeting is a fabulous way to comfort yourself and kind of help yourself through these things. But if you're not doing your steps, you won't grow. So, you know, at this point in my recovery, growth is like the most important thing. And doing the steps and being on a step is the most important thing to me. Carrying the message is the most important thing to me because I want, you know, I really love the promises that are in the AA book, the big book, that come, it's in the chapter, how it works after the ninth step. I rushed to the ninth step because I wanted my promises right away, and, you know, doesn't work that way either. but I got every one of them, I have to say. I didn't think the financial insecurity thing was going to leave me, and you know, today, some of the time, I really have that. I'm really freed up with that. And I don't know how that happens either, because I'm not, you know, I just make a living. I'm not wealthy. And so, but this 12 step, this 12 step thing, you know, and it's not hard. I mean, just showing up to a meeting is carrying the message. Any of it, you know, setting up chairs, sponsoring people if you can. Just come here. We'll take care of you. but the other thing is spiritual awakenings. And, you know, I just have them constantly. And I have this stupid thing I'm going to tell you that I did. So my husband and I have this condo in Pleasant Hill. And in the garage, there's this big board against the garage, because I think kind of a handy guy lived there before we did. And there were nails in it. And I hang these wreaths up that I use annually all around. And nails are never where I want them, you know? And it took me like a couple of years to figure out that I could get my handyman to put the nails where I wanted it. So I got Mike coming over to like nail this board up for me, right? And I got the nails in my hand. And before he comes in there, I look at this thing and realize it's a pegboard. That's insane. How long? That's a spiritual awakening. I'm going to tell you that is how spiritual awakenings work. And I called him and said, don't come. And I went over to Home Depot and I bought pegs. And I arranged my pegboard. But like, where was I the rest of the time? Seriously, and don't you, when you get things at a gut level, when you realize that maybe you're living with an alcoholic or maybe your kid's using, or like, where that information was all there before. You know, it's not like, you know, it wasn't there. I had a pegboard for how many years, you know? It's just. But I think that's a really good example of that. And then, there's two more things I wanted to say. One is that, thank you. One is that at the worst of my life, I would have to be the worst, I couldn't figure out how to make things change. I was in 12 steps, because this doesn't happen overnight. It just really, you know, nobody glows in the dark. I mean, it doesn't happen that way. So so I just want to tell you, I was at an all-time low. I guess I might as well tell you what it was. I was in a fatal attraction and couldn't get it to stop. And out of desperation, one of the things that I did was I started going back to Catholic Mass every single morning, because in Cleveland, the priest would come in every single morning at 6 o'clock and say Mass, and you could catch a 20-minute or a 30-minute Mass without all the frou-frou, and that's what I did, because I didn't know what else to do. And then there was, he'd held confession after that. And I was so slipping in my program that I was in that confessional every day. And what happened was, one day, I don't know how many times, I mean, he knew who I was, so it was just like, he said, you know, I want to tell you something. He said, I want to tell you that I know how spiritual a person is by the number of times they start over. And I can't tell you what a big relief that was. That, you know, instead of thinking I was just this idiot, he really respected that I was at my worst, at my bottom, you know. And those things were important to get me where I am now, you know. And so it didn't last very long. But I know I was telling this friend of mine, he goes, you're doing what? And he goes, so you're sitting up there with the old Italian ladies? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sitting up there with all the old Italian ladies. What are you going to do, you know? Jeez, that was pathetic. but somehow I needed to hear that thing. And actually, you know, I was sitting with a guru for a while, and he said the way he became enlightened was by failing at everything. And I really related to that. You know, it's like you have to keep failing and you have to keep failing. And then one of these days, you know, it's like you get it. And it's just not a bad thing. It's actually a pretty helpful thing. And then I'm going to stop. But I had one other thing to say. And, you know, that thing I told you that I went to at Oberlin College, it was a 12-step convention, and I got to hear, you know, one of the people I really respect, and he was had a lot of recovery on board, and was starting to get bored. And actually, he had this fabulous life. He had a business, and he was on his way to Africa to be on a safari, and just, you know, things humming along, you know, family good, the whole thing. And he used this prayer that I took with me as a, "Dear God, please help me to appreciate what I have without having to lose it first." Because that's where we go, isn't it? And I had another friend, too, one time who said to me, and this was really helpful, "Don't go to the pain for comfort." And, you know, growing up the way I grew up, you know, that business of going to the pain for comfort is just, you know, it's so knee-jerk. And so I really had to work to get that to stop. And so for the most part, you know, I don't. And then there was one other thing I wanted to say, but it's gone. So that's all you get.